Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 1999, the body of Haemin Lee was found in a shallow grave in Baltimore's Leakin Park. 6 weeks later, her ex-boyfriend, Adnan Syed, was arrested and charged with her murder. The state's case against Syed hinged entirely on the testimony of Jay Wilds, who said that he had been with Syed on the day of the murder and that he had assisted with the burial in Leakin Park. At trial, the prosecutor argued that although Wilds had repeatedly given false and inconsistent statements concerning the crime, his story was corroborated by Adnan's cell phone records. Syed was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Wilds pleaded guilty to accessory after the fact and was released without serving a day in prison. Last year, the creators of This American Life covered Syed's story in the popular podcast Serial. In order to better visualize the events that were being described on the show, attorney Susan Simpson put together a series of maps comparing the location data from the cell records with the various witness statements concerning the location of the phone throughout the day on which Haley was murdered. The results show just how fragmented and incoherent the prosecution's case was, as none of Wilde's multiple stories can be reconciled with the cell phone data. It also highlighted many of the gaps in the prosecution's evidence and showed how numerous witnesses who could potentially have confirmed or denied Jay's stories were never contacted by investigators. The focus of the program this evening is Serial, the ongoing story, with my special guest, attorney and blogger, Susan Simpson. And I would say welcome to the program, Susan Simpson, but there may be some technical difficulty. I apologize to all the critics who bring it up that I should be editing this portion of the program. I hope to God, for everyone's sake, Susan comes on right away. I got to say, sometimes it just are even problems on this end, technically on Blog Talk Radio, trying to maintain 1,000 programs at one time simultaneously, I believe, or at least hundreds of programs simultaneously. So sometimes that technology goes awry. Sometimes there are other problems, but that is a problem that occurs occasionally, and so we may be having that right now. For those of you have lived on another planet, I guess, but not everyone is aware of, here we go, thank God, Susan Simpson. Good evening, Susan Simpson.
Hello.
Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. I just did the intro, and I was telling the audience that we were waiting for you to connect, and sometimes there are just technical difficulties, but welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Susan Simpson.
Thanks for having me. I got the Skype figured out finally.
Ah, thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks to your audience. The audience will be thanking you as well, so I have to be subjected to minutes of me improvising. Now, tell us a little bit, Susan Simpson, about your background, because it is actually quite important. I mentioned in the introduction that you're an attorney. So tell us about your legal background and your blog, The View to LL2, and explain that, what the name is about, briefly, and tell us a little bit about you and your blog that you run.
Well, The View from LL2 is a blog that one of my friends from law school and I started when we graduated in 2009. It was mostly just a way to keep talking about things we talked about in law school and to sort of nerd out. even though we're no longer in classes. And it's mostly been about economics, international law, random topics. And for the past year or so, I've been carrying on alone as my co-blogger had to step down for professional reasons. And when Seal came out, I decided to start writing about that as well. Professionally, I'm both a criminal and civil litigator. My background is primarily civil, as well as 1 year of criminal appeals experience, and currently I'm doing white-collar crime.
Now, what intrigued you about this story? You just mentioned that this isn't, you know, primarily you didn't set out this blog to comment on Serial, but when this case started. So what was it about this case initially? And I guess you've learned a lot more in the following year that you've been involved with this, but tell us what initially really interested you in this case.
Actually, I had a friend of mine, or a former friend of mine, not too long ago, did something pretty horrific. And when I was sort of going through the process of trying to figure out how she'd done that and how to explain her actions, I kept coming across pages that referenced Serial, which I thought was a fictional at first, and I finally figured out it was a real story. And basically because of my own experiences with having a friend who did something that seemed impossible for them to have done, I started listening. And there's a lot I felt the show didn't cover, and I wanted to explore it further.
Okay, now for some of the people that may not, again, we have a big international audience, so again, I've just heard about Serial certainly not a year ago, so I'm pretty sure that other people like myself might not have heard of it till recently. So if we can, because we've only got about an hour or a little bit more than an hour, but let us recap the actual case itself in terms of introducing who Haymin Lee was and Adnan Syed. First, tell us about who these people are before we get to the actual murder itself, and then we'll just do a sort of a brief, because we can't get into the exploration that Serial did, certainly, and even that you've done on your blog. So tell us a little bit about these two characters, starting off with Haymin Lee. Who was Haymin Lee?
Haymin Lee was an 18-year-old high school student. She was a student at Woodlawn High School in the west side of Baltimore. She had been in a relationship, sort of off and on, with Adnan Syed since April 1998. They began dating after high school dance. And then after one or two breakups, they broke up for good around mid-December 1998. At that point, she began dating one of her coworkers, and Adnan also began dating or seeing other girls that he met in the neighborhood. And then approximately 3-4 weeks later, on January 13th, 1999, Hay went missing after leaving school one day, and her body was later found in a park on the west side of Baltimore called Lincoln Park, buried in a shallow grave.
Now, tell us, you basically give us a little outline of who she was. Now, tell us about the actual day that she goes missing and who reports her missing and how do they know she's missing and how do police proceed after this initial missing report?
The first sign that she's missing is when she fails to appear at a daycare to pick up her young cousin, which was, according to different statements, was supposed to be sometime around 3:15 or 3:30. Woodlawn High School got out at 2:15 that day, and there are reports of seeing Hay on campus anywhere from around about 2:30 to about 3 or even 3:15. There's conflicting statements there. It's unclear exactly when she left, but in general, it seems that somewhere between 2:45 and 3 o'clock is when she actually left campus. Where she went then or what happened next, there's very little idea. Approximately 3:30, 3:45, the daycare calls one of Hay's relatives and says that the cousin's still there, hasn't picked up. So then Hay's grandmother goes and picks up the girl from daycare. And about 2 hours later, 3 hours later, around 6 o'clock, Hay's brother calls the police to report her missing. The Baltimore County Police take a statement, make some calls to Hay's friends, including to Adnan. Don't learn anything. Don't do much then, and let it go. She does not reappear. And initially, none of her friends are concerned because there is a big ice storm that comes in the following that night, and there's no school on the 14th or 15th, and there's a holiday the Monday the next week. So it's not until Tuesday that they're back in school, and only about Wednesday, a week following her murder, that her friends start to become alarmed, and it becomes clear that something seriously wrong has occurred. On February 9th, after searches come up empty for her, a man driving through Lincoln Park pulls over, and according to him, to take a leak at the side of the road. When he does that, he finds a body, which he reports to the police.
Now, what do police do with this report? What do they do with this crime scene itself, and what do they establish from that crime scene, forensically?
It takes them about, well, initially, when they get to the scene, they find a very shallow grave, about 6 inches. It's unclear. There's no indication that tools were used to dig it. They're not sure what happened. They're not sure why the spot was chosen. It's approximately 127 feet off the road, in a very visible section of wooded area. You're still clearly inside of the cars from where her body was found. It's not a secluded area whatsoever. They find assorted potential evidence at the crime scene, things like spent casings, blocks, a rope, but it's unclear if any of these are connected to the crime. Her body itself is mostly covered with dirt and a few large rocks, but she's still somewhat visible, barely, which Mr. S., the man who found her, somehow saw. They do find, forensically, they find some hairs that don't belong to her and some fibers they can't identify. But other than that, very little forensic evidence is recovered. After they recover her body, the following day she's identified through fingerprint evidence. Her family is notified, and an announcement is made. And at that point, a search begins, or the investigation begins. Initially, there did not appear to be any suspects that are high on their radar, the cops' radar. But then on February 12th, an anonymous call was made by, according to police notes, a young Asian male who told him to start looking at Adnan Syed and said that he had been responsible for the murder, and that Adnan's friend Yasser could tell them more about it. That's when the police start their investigation into Adnan's role, and essentially when the police stop investigating anyone else.
Now, you do an exploration of this, and so does Sarah Koenig to a certain extent as well. Who is this Mr. S? We don't have to give his name or anything, but who is Mr. S? Is there... You know, in hindsight, everybody's a great investigator, but did anything strike police unusual about Mr. S? Was he investigated at all? I mean, isn't that somewhat routine to at least this person found the body? Was there anything suspicious at all is what I'm trying to ask.
There was a lot suspicious about him. He was investigated. They gave him 2 polygraphs because he failed the first one. He was a maintenance man, essentially, at a nearby college. And his story was that he just needed to relieve himself in the woods while driving back to work one day, and he happened to wander off the road and find her. The police were skeptical about this with good reason, because she was, despite the shallow grave, she was very well covered, and it does not seem very probable that someone just passing by would have seen her, or that under the circumstances he was in the woods, he would have found her gravesite. But that's a story he sticks with, and after a second polygraph in which the the person asking the question changes the questions entirely and stops asking questions about what he knows of the murder and only asks him if he knows about how she died, he manages to pass, and they write him off as a suspect. There's a lot of different speculation about how Mr. S could have found the body. One theory I've heard that I tend to favor is that perhaps Mr. S had seen something related to the burial while driving through at some point, or had been passing by and had seen activity in the woods. Because again, her body was not far from the Lincoln Park Road, and with the leaves gone for the winter, they would have been fully visible, whoever was there trying to dispose of the body. So it's possible he just saw that activity and later came by to figure out what was going on and found her. Or it's possible that his story about taking a bathroom break was true too, although I'm skeptical of that.
Now, initially, everything happens fairly quickly, not immediately, but fairly mm-hmm. quickly. So when police actually first spoke to Adnan, did it seem that he was in their sights sort of odds-wise, that it's either the boyfriend or the ex-boyfriend or somebody, you know, typically that's where the suspect would be, but was he in police sights when he first was questioned, and what did he say when he was questioned first by police on the telephone?
The first questioning, I guess, would be what happened the night of disappearance, and that was a routine questioning by the officer from Baltimore County Police who was conducting the missing person investigation. At that point, there were no suspects on the official record. It was a routine call to ask if he knew where Hay was, and there was nothing more to it at that point. Later on, I believe on February 1st, a different Baltimore County police officer has a fairly routine conversation with her, like he did with a lot of her friends. And he asks, well, when did you see her? What was going on? What have you heard? And Adnan makes a general statement saying that he last saw her at school. The cop does not ask anything about what happened later that day, what he had done or where he'd been, and leaves it at that. At that point, it seems like they may have been looking more into Hay's current boyfriend at the time of her disappearance, Don, but they can quickly rule out Don due to his, he was at work that day, and he has employment records showing that he was at his place of work and had not left during the time she disappeared. So they rule Don out, and then they start to focus more heavily on Adnan. They have a second statement planned where they want to meet with him and get a longer statement set for February 9th or 10th. But when they find Hay's body, they cancel that, and they don't talk to him again until, I believe, February 26th. And at that point, they're starting to heavily focus on him because on February 20th, 19th, somewhere around there, the police decide to request Adnan's cell phone records. And they also request at the same time a list of all cell towers in the area. The fax comes back from AT&T a couple days later, and on February 22nd, they realize that on the day of Hay's disappearance, Adnan had two phone calls that originated on the cell phone tower that's located just to the north of Lincoln Park. Once they see that, Adnan becomes their suspect full-on, and they pursue leads leading to him only, and pretty much no one else from that point onwards is ever a suspect.
Now, there's a lot to explain in this story here. It's incredible how this keeps unraveling and more and more questions. Let's talk about Adnan's alibi. What does he say to police to help try to rule him out of potential witness? What does he say? Where was he?
So one of the problems in this case is that there is no record of anyone asking Adnan where he was past about 5:30 until months after his arrest. There's no statement requested, none given. He's never gone on record until long after he's charged with her murder, talking about where he is from that point onwards. He does give a few statements about where he was prior to that time, and his story is that he last saw Hay at his last period on the 13th, and then afterwards he hung around school, went to the library, and waited for track practice, which began about 3:30. At 3:30, he went to track, which was over at 5:30. Well, I probably should back up here. There's a third character in the story that is pretty important, and that's Jay. Jay was a year ahead of Hay and Adnan. He'd graduated, and he was dating one of Adnan's best friends, Stephanie. Through Stephanie, Adnan and Jay had begun, in Adnan's words, kicking it per se, which basically meant they had they smoked up together. They weren't close friends, but they would go and smoke marijuana and hang out. So on the day of Hayes' appearance, Adnan and Jay had hung out during Adnan's free period around noon, and then Adnan had gone back to class, giving his car to Jay, because Jay had asked to borrow the car so he could go buy a present for his girlfriend. When he did so, Adnan left his cell phone in the glove compartment because the students were not allowed to have cell phones on campus. So, according to Adnan, from about noon onward, Jay had both his car and, by extension, his cell phone. So, rest of his day involved going to class, hanging out at school, going to track practice, and then when track was over, he called Jay and asked to be picked up. So, according to Adnan, Jay comes back about 5:30-ish, picks him up from track, and then the two of them decide to go visit one of Jay's friends, who Adnan's never met before, where they smoke weed and hang out. And according to Adnan, after that, at some point he and Jay leave Kathy's, and then eventually he drops off Jay somewhere, he doesn't recall where, and then he goes to mosque, gets some dinner for his father, who was at the mosque for Ramadan, and then after mosque goes home.
Now that can be corroborated, that bit of evidence, in terms of meeting up at the mosque and his father and that timeline.
It seems like he was certainly at the mosque at some point, and he was definitely at Kathy's at some point that afternoon. Where his alibi is less certain is what's happening earlier in the day. For instance, right after school, there are three witnesses who say they saw him on campus between about 2:15 and 3, Debbie, Becky, and Asia. And then there is the track coach who thinks he recalls seeing Adnan at practice on a day that could have been that day, but when asked about it a couple months later, he cannot say whether the day he recalls talking to Adnan on a warm day in January was in fact the 13th or not. So he does have an alibi, and there are people who think they've seen him at certain times at places where he says he was, but given that this questioning happened most cases months later, people don't know for sure the day they're calling is the day that Hay disappeared. So the prosecution claims that he was not there at all, he was not at school, he was not at track, he was busy killing Hay after school.
Now let's talk about the prosecution, because if people don't know this case at all, they're going to have to go, I think, and do some background information, because this is a confusing case, because we're going to jump into this and see what was wrong with the case. And there's a big, important story here, because there's so much information now. There's so many people looking at this case, Innocent Project, and so many people working on this. So let's talk about what the prosecution's theory was right from the very beginning, and that, of course, comes from the police. So tell us what the police thought, and then in relation what the prosecution thought on how this went down. And why? What was the motive? And at the end of this, tell us how Hay Min Lee was actually killed.
The motive so the police start to center in on Adnan after the anonymous call comes in, telling them that he's responsible and they should look at him. The police seem to latch on to a Muslim honor killing theory, where something to do with Adnan's religion, motive, and domestic violence combined caused him to want to kill Hay because she'd broken up with him when he had lied to his family to date her, and he'd not been a good Muslim to date her. And so apparently out of revenge for her making him not be a good Muslim and then breaking up with him, he kills her in a rage. The detectives, there's one line in the reports where the detectives note how they went to go speak to a Hindu that was friends with Adnan in order to ask about Islam and find out more about it. So you can see the level of the investigation in terms of the religious angle. Off-key they were.
Now, with Adnan, because we haven't really talked about this, and there is, of course, you're bringing up this issue that he was this Muslim that was hiding this relationship with this woman because he was attended mosque, so he was, again, there's some, I guess, talk of that he had this religion that he was defying and his family that he was defying by dating. But very much like Sarah Koenig did and yourself, you've looked at the evidence and he's an American. So tell us who he really was and tell us about this theory, again, that you refute and she refutes too, that this theory that the prosecution has, that this was based about his religion and his shame from his family and the lifestyle of the culture that he lived in.
You know, the theory was never very coherent in the first place, so it's hard to even articulate what their idea of this was. They make lots of references to besmirched honor and to persecution of women and to sort of a patriarchal, anti-male society in which an honor killing occurs, even though this is not the context of what an honor killing would be. It's never really explained in detail. The best summary of it is, well, Islam. That's kind of as far as I got with it. Even people who think Adnan is guilty don't really buy that anymore. I mean, I've never heard anyone actually in today's discussion of the case actually buy into that whole theory because it's bogus. There's nothing there. He was an American. I mean, he was out smoking weed in Ramadan. That's the kind. He was a 17-year-old American kid from a Muslim background, Muslim faith, and a Pakistani background, and whatever happened, that had little or nothing to do with it whatsoever.
Now, tell our audience how Jay becomes involved and then introduce Jen and tell us who Jen is in relationship to Adnan and to Jay. Tell us how Jay gets involved and what do the police, tell us that story and what police do when they do speak with Jay.
So the police pull Adnan's cell phone records. And the cell phone records show, like I mentioned earlier, that at 7:09 and 7:16 p.m., two phone calls are received that originate on a tower called L689B, the Lincoln Park Tower, which is really close to where Hay was buried.
Right.
The police then decide this is proof that Adnan killed her. Hay was buried then. Here's the proof they needed. And to top it all off, there's two later calls at 6:04 or 8:04 and 8:05 p.m. that originate on a tower fairly close to where Hay's car was later found abandoned. So, well, they don't even know that at the time. So right now, at this stage of the investigation, all they're going on are these two phone calls that just happened to ping the tower that's near her body. The police also noticed, looking at the call log, that there were an awful lot of calls made that day to a certain phone number, or two phone numbers belonging to one person, Jen Pusateri. She is called far more than anyone else that day, I think 7 times in all, and she's called at all times during the day, morning, afternoon, evening. His phone is calling her a lot. So the police decide they need to talk to her. They go to her house and say, we want to talk to you about Haley's murder. Can you tell us about it? And she initially says nothing. She balks. She gets a little panicked and quiet. She says, yes, she knew Haley. She was a year ahead of Hay, too. She was in Jay's class. but she didn't really know Hay or Adnan. And the police ask her to come down to the police station later that day to talk. She agrees, kind of reluctantly, but before she goes down to the police station, she gets her friend Kathy, and she goes to talk to Jay at the adult video store where he worked. And she and him have a discussion. There's different accounts of what they talk about. But after this discussion with Jay, she then goes back down to the police station, where she gives an official but very vague statement in which she says she knows Haley, she knows Adnan, she knows Jay. She knows that Hay was killed by strangulation, which was not officially released yet, but she doesn't want to say anything else. At the end of the short statement, Jin asks the police, "Am I a suspect?" And the police tell her, "Everyone is and no one is." So she goes home. The following day, so February 27th, Jin apparently freaks out. We don't know what happens, but she talks to her parents, tells something, and they lawyer up. So that afternoon, she goes back down to the police station with her mother and a lawyer and makes an official statement. And this time, she acknowledges knowing more than what she said before. Her account is, it's contradictory. It's a confusing mess. It's hard to say exactly what she's saying because she doesn't even seem to know. But she gives a story about how on the 13th, which the police tell her it's the 13th, because they give her the phone log and remind her what day it occurred on. She says, right. Well, yes, it's possible Adnan was calling the house. I don't remember that, but he might have been calling Jay at my house. Jay's a friend of mine. We're good buddies. We hung out that day. And Jay was over at my house with a cell phone waiting for Adnan to call. And when Adnan called him on the cell phone, he left. And then Jin says that about 4 hours later, after some confusing phone tag between her and Jay on Adnan's cell phone, she gets a request from Jay to pick him up at a nearby mall at around 8 o'clock. So according to Jin, she goes to the mall, and Adnan drives up, drops off Jay, and Jay gets in her car. Adnan seems normal. Everything's fine. According to Jin, the only conversation they have is when Adnan says, "Hey, girl," and then drives off. When Jay gets in the car, he tells her that Adnan killed Hay. And Jin, according to her, and I quote, she asks him all the normal questions you would ask, who, what, where, when, why. And Jay doesn't really tell her to know much. He knows some things that Adnan tells him about what happened, but he doesn't really know where the murder occurred, other than it was in a car. And then, as they're driving away from the mall, Jay tells her, "Turn around, go back to the mall. I have to go wipe down the shovels." So they go back. Jin never sees the shovels or shovel. She's not sure how many there are. She never sees them. But she lets Jay off at a dumpster where he says he goes to wipe down some shovels for fingerprints, and then gets back in the car. Things get confusing from there. Jin has about 4 different versions of the next events, but they all kind of involve, at various times, a trip to see Jay's girlfriend, Stephanie, a trip to throw away Jay's clothes, and then finally a trip to see Kathy again that evening. So after they talk to Jin and get this story from her, they decide that the next person to talk to is Jay. So at this point, it's about 11:30 p.m., on the 27th, and they drive down to the adult video store and pick up Jay to get his statement. So they get back to the police station about 12 a.m., and they spend about 45 minutes to an hour talking off the record. We don't know what they say. We know that at some point during the discussion, Jay tells them he's going to come clean, but we don't know what he comes clean about because no tape recorder is turned on until about 1 a.m. At that point, when the tape recorder is turned on, Jay gives a statement about how, essentially how Adnan asked for his help in picking Adnan up after he committed the murder of Hay, and that Jay borrowed Adnan's car and cell phone so that after Adnan killed Hay, Adnan could call Jay and ask for a ride after it. According to the story that Jay gives this time, Adnan calls for a ride when he's downtownish, sort of down in the city, at this sort of strip where they sell drugs, kind of near Lincoln Park. So Jay goes to pick him up, and Adnan says, "Hey, check it out, check it out." And he pops open the trunk, and Hay's body is, as Jay puts it, pretzeled up there. And Jay then recounts a very confusing story that involves them driving all around West Baltimore and making stops at various places, including Patapsco State Park, smoking some weed there, discussing the murder, then driving back to track practice, going to Kathy's, then burying her body in the woods. It doesn't match Jen's story in any respects except for the two things. One, both Jen and Jay insist over and over again that he went to pick Adnan up after Hay's murder at 3:40 p.m., and both of them say that Jay was picked up by Jen at the mall at around 8 o'clock. Other than that, the details don't really match up between their stories.
Now, with this investigation, you say that she grabs a lawyer. Jay has a... And Jay makes statements to the police without a lawyer as well. Is that correct? And then he does gain an attorney?
Correct. Well, what happens is they tell Jay that if he does not tell them that how Adnan committed this murder, they're going to charge him for Hay's death. So apparently, and this is all off tape, so we don't know exactly what was said, but we do know they told him, turn on Adnan or else charging you, and here's a sheet where you can sign away your right to an attorney and agree to talk to us. So Jay agrees to both those things and gives his statement. But unlike Jen, he has no attorney. There's no official deal going on other than that the detectives promise him that if he turns on Hay or turns on Adnan, he won't be charged with the murder.
Now tell us about, because it's very important, I think anyway, and I wanted to ask you about this as well, is that it always depends on what kind of lawyer you have in terms of experience. And sometimes a better lawyer comes from being very experienced and not being a very, very junior duty counsel, we'll say. So tell us about I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, but tell us about the lawyer that comes on board and what that lawyer doing the best for his client trying to negotiate.
So in between February 28th, and trial, Jay gives four statements to the police. He does not have an attorney for any one of them. He agrees to talk without it. He signs a little form waiving his right to an attorney and talks to them. At some point, Jay starts to get nervous and starts to want an attorney, which is, reasonable of him. So he starts, this is probably around early fall, late summer, he starts calling the public defender's office and asking to get an attorney. At that point, he's informed, well, you can't get an attorney until you're charged with something. So he tries calling the prosecutor and tries to figure out what's going on. On September 7th, the cops come to his door unannounced, pick him up, and drive him down to the prosecutor's office, where the prosecutor, Kevin Urich, says, there's someone I want you to meet. So Urich takes Jay to a room where he introduces him to his friend, Ann Benaroya, who is an attorney who sometimes handles criminal issues. She is a personal friend or acquaintance of Urich's, and Urich has personally reached out to her and said, hey, I've got this person here who really deserves help. Can you come meet with him and represent him? She agrees, so they meet for the first time on September 7th. They, Benaroya and Jay sit down for about an hour-long discussion with each other, and by the end of it, Jay's agreed to accept Benaroya's counsel free of charge, and he's also agreed to enter a plea deal with the state, which is absurdly quick. So he meets the prosecutor, meets his new attorney that's been handpicked. They work out a plea deal, then they instantly go down to the courthouse where they sort of enter in this plea deal. And they don't use the official way of doing it. It's a very unusual way of entering a plea. There's no proffer of facts. There's no agreement on the sentence range that's going to happen. it's kind of informal in some ways, and it's not very enforceable. It's more like a gentleman's agreement that Yurik will not seek an overly harsh charge against Jay if Jay says what Yurik wants him to say.
Now, I thought this was one of the most important things that you've made in your blog, in your entries, in your postings, is that, and again, it's a big accusation and allegation, but again, you provide the foundation for it. You say that with the interviews that he had, each subsequent interview, he would have there was a gap, various time periods of gap where he'd have a pre-interview, and who knows exactly what was said in that pre-interview, and then he would have an interview. And he had four interviews, but each subsequent interview would have a pre-interview and then an interview. And each of those, and you go through it and you break it apart, very much like Serial does as well, but you do even more of an analysis in that the inconsistencies that are in those stories, and then you make the statement that they had plenty of time for the police to be able to give him enough information for him to be able to correct the mistakes that he did have in terms of correct the mistakes that they did make, and so that he could have a statement at trial. And you say that he was interested because a part of that agreement was that if he were to be caught up in lies, then that agreement would be, and again, you said it was a gentleman's agreement, so if he were to be caught up in a lie or caught to be in a lie with this, that it would negate the agreement itself. How much credit or discredit are you giving to the lawyer, though, in maybe this guy didn't have this in terms of his own bright idea. How much of this is put at the lawyer's feet for doing this, negotiating this with the help of the prosecution to be able to make this tailor-made, consistent statement at trial?
One of the more concerning parts of the plea agreement is that it states, if Jay has lied in any single prior police statement, the deal's null and void. This is a problem because Jay has already admitted in every single interview that he lied in the previous interview. So there's no question that Jay has lied. Well, at least the first three, he definitely lied, because in the last interview, he's like, oh yeah, I lied in the last one too. So there's no question the plea deal's already null and void, which means Jay could have assumed, and probably recently did assume, that in order for this deal not to be totally worthless, he has to keep the prosecutor happy. In any event, the fact that Jay had given so many different and wildly different stories ought to have concerned the prosecutor when he was trying to get Jay to give a single story. Because the other part of the plea deal was that Jay had to tell the truth at trial. But given how many different statements he's made, how is the prosecutor supposed to know what the truth is or to know if Jay has broken that part of the agreement? Also, to go back a bit, in the four statements he'd given, actually only the first two had a pre-interview and then a recorded interview. The first interview was about an hour-long pre-interview and then the recorded session. The second interview was a three-hour pre-interview and then the recorded session. The third interview has no recording whatsoever, but there are some police notes about it. And the fourth and last interview, there is a one-line page that says, on April 13th, the police picked up Jay and spoke to him to resolve inconsistencies about locations. And that's it. There's no notes. We don't know what he said. We'll never know what he said because there's no more data about what happened in that fourth interview. So in between from the interview one to interview four, the story changes quite a bit, and you can see more than enough room for the prosecutor or for the investigators to discuss those changes with Jay and to help him along. And in fact, actually at trial, it was a detective that says, well, once we show Jay the phone records, he remembered things a lot better. So the cops themselves acknowledge that Jay's story changed directly in response to the phone logs they showed him.
Now, the other thing that you're talking about, too, because you really are talking about malfeasance here, you're talking about the prosecution being underhanded, doing things that are not normal, that they took a very weak premise, motive, and underhandedly, you know, there's not any nice way of saying this, but this, mm-hmm. it that they took information like the cell phone information, and you go and dissect this because this is very, very important, because they hinge this in the end on this, and the defense attorney cannot, defense attorney can't counter this at all. So talk about cell phone records. Talk about the technology itself. Tell us about this. This is incredible, the investigation you've done to be able to explain this. So please explain that.
So I think it's important to note first that I'm not accusing the investigators or prosecution of being underhanded themselves, or not intentionally so. I think they deceived themselves much as they did anyone else. This was not a conspiracy they planned out. It was not something they decided one day, oh, hey, let's go try and get this innocent person in jail. It was them assuming, based on faulty evidence, they knew who their guy was, and then pursuing all routes, whether they were at good ideas or not, in order to get their case against him. So it's, as you go along, it's definitely not a case of them trying to fabricate evidence or trying to falsely get this guy for a crime they know he didn't commit. They think he did it, and they want to make sure they have a witness who can say how he did it. So to make sure their witness can explain how their guy is guilty, they give him the info he needs. In this case, the info that Jay needed in order to give a story that could convict Adnan came in the form of the cell phone records, both in the form of a cell phone, the call records, which is who was called when, how long the call was, and the location data, which is the cell site tower that the call went through when it was made. So starting with the call logs, in the very first interview with Jen and with Jay, the cops do tell them both, hey, look, we have these calls that show you were talking to Adnan on the day of Hayes' appearance, and we know that you were involved. Tell us how. But there's less coaching going on in Jay's first interview overall, because Jay only remembers 3 phone calls out of 31 that occurred. So, yeah. Back up a bit again. There were 31 phone calls made from Adnan's cell phone from 10:45 through midnight, the day of Hayes' appearance. So out of those 31 calls, Jay only remembers 3 in the first interview. And none of them match the cell phone data. They're all way off. So going into the second interview, about a month later, the cops have the goal, and they've said this, they have the goal of trying to reconcile Jay's story with the physical phone records, because they're just not matching up. The locations are wrong, the call times are way wrong, the people being called are wrong. So they show him the phone logs in full and ask him to explain what was going on in each call, where he was when it was made, what it was about, and who he was talking to. And from the first interview to the second interview, there is a sea change in Jay's story. Suddenly he recalls just about every phone call that happened that day, sort of. He claims to recall them, but when the cops try and press him for details, he kind of ends up babbling and making up explanations that sound false. For instance, when trying to explain all the incoming calls that happened that afternoon, he talks about how Adnan calls just to say hi, or just check and see if the phone was on, or just to give him a heads up that he's going to call again in a half hour. So Jay is trying to make up explanations for all these calls, but it's pretty clear that the cops are showing him the log and saying, explain this, and Jay is doing his best to play along with it. The problem is, even after the second interview, his story still isn't matching. To give one example, in Jay's first interview, he tells the cops that after dropping Adnan off at track practice after the murder, he then goes to his house to smoke a blunt and wait for Adnan to call. In the second interview, he changes the story. Suddenly he says that, oh, he didn't go to his house. He, after dropping Adnan at track, he went to a park, and then he went to Kathy's house to smoke a blunt, and then went to pick up Adnan. Which doesn't actually make any sense, because when you start looking at the location data from the cell phone records, you can see that the phone call that was made after, while Adnan's at track, which would be the 4, 4:30 calls. The calls are around 4:30, 4:58. The cell phone site for both those calls is right next to Jay's house. So his original story about being at his own home actually kind of makes sense. The time is wrong. He says it takes place about an hour and a half later than it really did. But the location, for once, and probably the only time in his stories, actually matches the cell phone records. And then in the second interview, he mysteriously changes his story to be completely wrong. He now claims he's at Kathy's, which is a different part of town, different tower, nowhere near the tower that does originate for those calls. And this part had bothered me for a while, because most of the time when Jay's story changes, it changes to match his cell phone records. This is the one time when he's changed his story to contradict the cell phone records. But what it turns out actually happened is that the cell phone data the cops were working with was wrong. The cops erroneously believed that the calls that happened while Adnan was at track had originated on a tower that was next to Kathy's apartment. It was 3 miles north of there, but the cops thought wrongly that it was. So in the second interview, they go in and say, hey, look, we know you're lying. You're not at your house. The cell phone records clearly show you were somewhere near Kathy's when these calls happened. So tell us where you were. And then Jay says, well, it's at Kathy's, because that's what the records show. So you can see how the cops made him change his story, even though his story was probably more accurate and could have been more correct the first time around.
Now, you also talk about what happens at trial with the cell phone expert, and that you say that, again, when I say underhanded, you could term it whatever you want. I will take the heat for underhanded, where you talk about 2 out of the 11 documents are given as part of discovery to the defense, but the other 9 are given orally, an oral account, which helps the prosecution, and you contend. Tell us about that, what you contend with that.
Well, I'll agree that part was underhanded, too. That was discovery. They were essentially trying to deprive the defense of any information that would allow them to counteract the cell phone expert's testimony.
Right.
So, as a backstory, the cell phone expert was retained by the prosecution in order to test 13 separate sites around West Baltimore that were sort of relevant to this case. And they wanted the cell phone expert to find out where a call from these locations, or which tower it would originate on, so that they could figure out if their theory of the case matched the cell records. So they drive the expert around, and he uses test equipment to take readings at all these sites. And then when the prosecution has to disclose the result of this testing to the defense, what they do is not provide the results, which were computer-generated, have GPS location, and show in detail what the results were. They provide a brief one-page summary of the expert's oral statements. What this essentially means is that as they drove around, they had the expert read out select results from his computer and then toss out all the computer records. So they didn't keep what the computer found. They didn't keep the actual location data they required. They just used what he told them orally in the car driving around, wrote some of those numbers down, and gave it to the defense. They did keep the computer data for 2 of the locations they tested. That was Kathy's house and a park near Jay's house, which is significant because, 1, both of these locations have little to no relevance to the murder whatsoever, and 2, they're the 2 locations farthest from Lincoln Park. What I suspect, and can't prove and can never prove now, is that the reason they chose these 2 irrelevant locations to actually save the computer data was because for every other location, the Lincoln Park Tower reached. So if they had disclosed those maps, it probably would have shown that the Park Tower, L689B, did have a signal somewhere outside of Lincoln Park. Since the prosecution's entire case hinged upon proving that Adnan was in Lincoln Park when the L689B tower was pinged, having proof that a call made from somewhere completely not Lincoln Park pinged that tower would have killed their case. So I don't know that's what the case is. I don't know that L689B definitely reached those locations. but the fact that prosecution chose to only disclose the two maps farthest from Lincoln Park does suggest there's a reason. They were scared of having maps of cell reception from close to Lincoln Park get into the hands of the defense.
Well, you know, you're a criminal attorney. Let's, you know, we have some more time here to look at this case, but mm-hmm. overall they didn't they had a shaky case that they took to a jury. They had a defense attorney that seemed to be confused and not very concise in her arguments. And
yes.
One hell of an annoying voice, I got to say that.
It's true.
You know, the opposite of charming, I would think. I mean, really. So obviously, I think, you know, and I'm not a lawyer, but having looked at a lot of cases, which was one of the more interesting things is what Sarah Koenig interviewed or hired, a private detective to look at the case, and mm-hmm. he said something that was surprising to her, but not so surprising to me. He said, overall, when he looked at the case, yeah, this is, the vast majority of cases are done like this. This doesn't look like something that isn't done almost routinely. So he's seen better, he's seen worse, but wasn't so bad in terms of, you know, I think a lot of people, maybe some people are naive, that lots of things don't fit, and prosecution takes a lot of cases to a jury with sort of far-flung motives, or let's put it this way, very unsubstantiated motives, unprovable motives, we'll say, weak cases taken to a jury oftentimes. So I guess I should get a question out of that, but what I thought was that this case is obviously a case where there's reasonable doubt regarding Adnad's guilt. But I really like to look at a case and say, what do you think in terms of guilt? And tell us what you think after
so,
all of this year.
Jim Trainum is the expert that Koenig talked to, and he did say that it was an above-average investigation in terms of trying to track down the suspect. And they did a lot of legwork. They did a lot of research. They didn't just write this one off. They tried to prove a case. But even Jim Trainum agreed when he was asked about what he thought overall the state's case, that there were holes here that were bigger than normal. This was not an average case because the prosecution's case never came together. There was always huge holes in it that couldn't be explained and shouldn't have been there if their theory was right. And the obvious explanation is that the theory was never right because their star witness, Jay, was perjuring himself constantly on the stand. Jay has fully acknowledged now in a recent interview that he lied his butt off at both of Adnan's trials. Everything he said, essentially, other than the fact that Adnan killed Hay, was a lie. And he was happy to acknowledge this because he had his reasons for lying. So it's pretty clear, whether you think Adnan's guilty or innocent, why the state's case was such an incoherent mess. And that's that it's all based on lies. It's all based on Jay's lies. It's all based on Jay's nonsense, crazy, manufactured statements. The problem is that leaves us with basically where we started. Jay could be lying and Adnan could still be guilty, or Jay could be lying because Adnan's innocent and Jay's just trying really hard to hide who's actually responsible. And in the end, Jay's stories just don't get us anywhere. They're too incoherent, they're too contradictory, they are too provably false to provide any basis for explaining how Hay died. And since the investigation stopped as soon as Adnan was identified as the prime target, there is no other research or contemporaneous information concerning who else might have killed her or how she might have died. So we are left with just a black hole in terms of actual evidence here of what might have happened, because the state's whole case was based on investigating a lie that they did not allegedly know was a lie at the time. So the data they have doesn't match up with anything. And the data we have now is trying to piece together a 15-year-old story. Basically, it's really hard to give a firm answer here because we don't have the evidence. We're not ever going to have the evidence short of a confession. And trying to figure out exactly what did occur is a fool's errand.
Is there enough evidence to say that at least one of the two was a participant in the murder? And if so, which one does the evidence conclude was involved?
Jay was a participant. There's still some arguments that he was giving a false confession entirely and had no involvement. And I can't say that's totally impossible, but I don't find it very plausible based on what we know. The big fact, quote unquote, is that Jay knew where Hayes' car was. He led the cops to where Hayes' car was abandoned, which the cops had apparently not found, even though it was near Lincoln Park. So we can say with some confidence that Jay was involved somehow in the cover-up of the murder, but we don't actually have anything linking Jay to the murder itself, and I don't think we can say, we definitely cannot say that Jay was responsible for it, and I don't really have an opinion if he was or not, because the evidence is too vague and can go either way. At this point, I think Adnan's innocent, but that's mostly a result of the way the investigation was carried out. If Adnan was guilty, the prosecution should have, by dumb luck, stumbled on some kind of evidence to support that. And the fact that their investigation consistently found things that did not lead to his guilt suggests to me that the reason they couldn't find anything is because it wasn't there.
Now, you talked... It's incredible the story itself in terms of what Jay says, and his friend backs him up, I think Josh, where he talks about why on earth Adnan would have done this and then recruited Jay, and Jay would have agreed to it. So tell us what Jay's version and his friend's version of why on earth Jay became involved.
Jay's versions for why he helped start with, his first story ever is that Adnan threatened to expose his weed dealing business if he didn't help Adnan bury Hayes' body. And Jay was allegedly so scared by this that he agreed, because the guy with a body in a trunk is going to threaten to turn you into the cops. I don't know. Jay says he believed it, so it must be true. Later on, and like in the recent interviews he's given, he says that the reason he helped out was because he was scared of getting his family in trouble with his drug operation. He's vague on details and just kind of leaves it as this kind of a martyr complex, really. Like he buried this body in order to save his grandma, is what it comes down to. And there's no real coherent story behind it. There's no way to explain it logically, because Jay was not afraid of Adnan. There was no reason to be afraid of Adnan. If Adnan could have threatened Jay, he would have known not to do it. So whatever reason Jay helped, he's never said it. If Adnan did kill Hay, we still don't know why Jay decided to assist in the cover-up.
Is there any link whatsoever? I know that the police didn't make any, and certainly the serial program didn't allude to or point to. Is there any connection whatsoever, any possibility that there was a connection between Heyman and Jay?
Well,
any reason they to be connected?
They were connected, and they were classmates. They had classes together. They had mutual friends together. They knew each other. They weren't friends. Most of the connection comes from Hay's relationship with Adnan, and through Adnan, Stephanie, and through Stephanie, Jay. So there's no close relationship there, and I do think Jay is the linchpin. He's the connection, even if he's not responsible for the murder. Something about him was a connection that led Hay to whatever happened on that day. There is speculation for why Jay might have had a motive. I don't really give much of it credence, because everything is so vague here. It could be true, it could not be. I don't think it's worth spending time worrying about it. One of the more common themes or common stories is that Jay was jealous of Adnan's close relationship with Stephanie, because Stephanie and Adnan were really good friends and used to date. And so apparently Jay was jealous of that and decided to kill Hay. But that doesn't really make sense either. If I had to guess, I think a drug connection's going on. That's what a lot of the evidence seems to lead back to. But that's definitely not the only answer, and it could turn out to be a lot of different things that happened. Again, like the number of possibilities here has never been narrowed down. Someone had a thought experiment once, which I thought was a pretty useful way of showing how little we know. And that's just, if you could choose any location and time on January 13th where you could have a camera for 15 minutes and see what happened there, where would you choose to go? And there's nowhere to, like, there's no place you could choose to look at and try and figure out this case. We don't know where she died. We don't know how she died. Exactly, we don't know when she died. We don't know what time she was buried. We don't know where she was kept in between the murder and the burial. We don't know where the actors were at various times. Even with a magic camera that could show you 15 minutes of any place in Baltimore on that day, it is very unlikely you could solve the crime.
Well, you know what I found interesting, too, just very much like you make the case that the prosecution manipulated the information, gave it back to their witness, and then massaged it into a form that they could work with, that worked with certain things, worked with their theory. There seemed to be, and I'll get your response to this, Jen and Josh, it seemed to be people, again, Jay's story doesn't make very much sense. Adnan's story and response doesn't seem to make that much sense, and these witnesses don't seem to make that much sense when they're doing stories that are supposedly going to help their friends. We talk about with Josh saying that he was and backing up the story from Jay, which seemed unlikely from the characterization of Adnan and who Jay really was, that he was so terrified of what Adnan might do. What do you think about the friends' connections and some of their stories?
I think, obviously, the friends are relating what they've been told. So it's really difficult from our position now to differentiate between the friends that are just repeating what they heard and the friends who are distorting the story to try and protect something. So, I mean, Jen, for instance, I completely believe that she was asked by Jay and she agreed to give a false alibi for where Jay was on the afternoon of Hayes' murder, because their story is both that he was at her house until 3:40 p.m. That's provably false through a bunch of different ways. So he wasn't there. She's lying about that. He's lying about that. They clearly worked together to have an alibi. But we don't know why Jen agreed. Jen could have agreed because she wanted to make sure her friend who was innocent in a murder didn't falsely get accused of it. Right. Or she could be giving a false alibi because she knows he's guilty and wants to help him. So even we know that people are lying, we still don't know why. And I think it all goes back to the investigation and how the cops had one theory, centered in on it, and looked only there for the rest of the time. As a result, the data we have is so limited that we can't rule out any other theory. I mean, we can rule out the story at trial. We know enough to disprove what they claimed happened at trial. But we can't really disprove anything else.
And what is the status of Adnan's appeals? Does he have any? Is there any more options for him? Is there anything left for him to look forward to? Is there any appeals left? Tell us what his status is.
So the current appeal that's ongoing is it was an appeal based on, well, in part on ineffective assistance of counsel, based on Adnan's attorney's failure to call an alibi witness who saw him at the library at 2:45 p.m. That appeal was denied in January last year. It's recently the defense filed a motion to reopen it. And most recently, as you may have heard, the defense filed an affidavit from the alibi witness, Asia McLean, in which she stated that, one, she stood by her alibi story, that she'd seen Adnan in the library at 2:45 when the prosecution claimed at trial that he had killed her before 2:36 p.m., and two, that the reason she hadn't come forward sooner and that she hadn't actually given the story at trial was because and why she hadn't given it in a previous appeal was because she'd spoken to Yurik, the prosecutor, and he'd convinced her not to. So based on that affidavit, they're trying to have his ineffective assistance of counsel appeal upheld. The latest update there is that the prosecution has filed a motion to strike the affidavit from the record, claiming it was filed too late. So it's not clear how that's going to get resolved. If that appeal fails, there are other options. He could potentially file a federal appeal. There's other state-level claims he can make. His best hope, although who knows how likely it is his options through the Innocence Project, who have taken on his case and are looking into possible DNA evidence that may still exist. If they can find the DNA evidence still safe somewhere in the police files, and if they can test that and have a match to someone else, that would be his best route to freedom. But there's a lot of steps there. One, finding the evidence. Two, actually having DNA on it. And three, actually having the court allowing them to test it. But then going back to the DNA evidence, that's another good example of how the prosecution failed here so horribly. Because Jay told the cops from day one, when he's discussing his imaginary conversations with Adnan, that Adnan told him that he was worried that there was forensic evidence under Hay's fingernails. He was worried that she had scratched him somehow, and there was evidence that he'd killed her under her fingernails. And yet, the prosecution never tests that DNA evidence. They put it on hold and decided not to test it, which I cannot understand. Forensics aren't always there. It's usually a long shot. But when you have a witness saying that the defendant was worried there was DNA evidence under the victim's fingernails, why wouldn't you test it?
Right. How important is Asia McLean's affidavit in light of her believability that she wasn't asked by the prosecution or police? It wasn't followed up. The defense didn't have a chance to even know about this. So how important is that to potential appeal?
Actually, it's not. The prosecution never knew about her. The cops never talked to her. It's not them who knew about her. It was Adnan. She contacted Adnan and said, look, I saw you there. We were there at the library. Let me know if you need me. And Adnan passed the information on to his attorney, and she ignored it. She just ignored it. She flat out didn't call Asia, didn't follow up, didn't find out what's going on, didn't even try and figure out if she was a useful alibi witness, which you can't do. I mean, when it comes to ineffective assistance of counsel, there's a lot of leeway. Attorneys can have strategies. Just because you're wrong doesn't mean you're ineffective. But the one thing you always have to do is to investigate. You have to talk to an alibi witness and find out why or why not they're useful for the case. So I think she's believable. I think she's totally honest. I have no reason to doubt her. The biggest problem with Asia in terms of solving the case is that even though I think she very much saw Adnan in the library at 2:45 p.m., her testimony is only relevant based on the prosecution's fantasy fairy tale timeline of events. Because the prosecution claims Hay was dead at 2:36. So in that case, Asia's crucial. Her testimony disproves it entirely. The problem is no one actually believes prosecution. Everyone knows that the prosecution was making it up when they claimed Hay was dead at 2:36. So in reality, in a world where the evidence shows that Hay was almost certainly killed from between 3 p.m. and 3:30, having a solid alibi for 2:45 p.m. isn't factual proof that Adnan's innocent. It is, however, very useful evidence for showing that his attorney was ineffective and that he did not get a constitutionally fair trial because of her failure to investigate.
So inadvertently, that will have worked out possibly for Adnan.
In some respects, I mean, it would have been better for him if she looked it up back in 1999. But
sure.
It's not technicality. I mean, this is a sign. One, the prosecution claims that Hay died at 2:36. So it's not a technicality for someone to be shown to have a failed defense due to the fact that his attorney didn't show that he could not have killed her at 2:36. And second, this is one problem with Christina Gutierrez's entire defense. This is not the only one.
what other parts of her strategy were lacking significantly?
My biggest criticism of her is her failure to stop the prosecution from playing the games it was playing. The prosecution made late and incomplete disclosures at every stage of the game. They did not give important information. They withheld information. And she mostly rolled over and took it. She fought back at some points. She would try and she filed a couple motions to compel. She did try at some places to get the information the state was withholding. But overall, given how much they were withholding, she was inexplicable in her failure not to pursue it further. As a result, going into both trials, she had no idea what was coming in some respects. She didn't have the full timeline. She didn't have Jay's statements. She didn't know that Jin was a witness. She didn't know anything in some respects. So for me, like as an attorney strategy-wise, that was her biggest failure. If she had simply followed up, filed whatever it took to force the prosecution to play fair, he would have been in much better shape going into trial. In terms of actual, given the lack of discovery, in terms of what she did at trial, her cross-examinations were meandering, to put it nicely. And what kind of kills me reading the transcripts now is that Giddy Ayers was a smart woman. You can see there's so many times where I've seen in the transcripts that she saw a problem in the case. She clearly identified something that was hugely important, like, for instance, the fact the lividity, liver mortis in the body did not match its positioning in the grave. She saw that as a problem, and she tried to question the medical examiner about it. And I didn't even realize that was a problem until later on. I went back and read it. And I'd completely overlooked the fact that Giddy Ayers was trying to get that out. She was trying, like, her questioning shows she knew that this disproved the state's case, and she wanted to question the medical examiner about it, but she keeps losing her train of thought. The question that follows it up is never there. And so even though she starts bringing these huge, important issues up and solve them, she never delivers.
There was some talk that she was a little bit different in terms of effectiveness, in terms of energy, and maybe even focus from one trial to the next.
So I do fully believe that. I think there was two huge problems here. I think that, one, she was being unethical in how she handled client funds. I don't see a way around that. She was very unethical in what she did to clients, how she treated them, how she approached cases. She took money, didn't do the work. She didn't retain experts. She didn't follow up on witnesses. She was clearly unethical, and I think intentionally so. On the other hand, I think she was also actually sick and struggling, and I think that shows up in the cross-examination, where she was trying. And she wasn't trying to get her clients in jail, but she was phoning it in on the preparation. And then when it came to trial day, she didn't have the health or the energy or mental resources to follow through. Perhaps early in her career, it wouldn't have mattered if she hadn't done the back work because she was a good trial attorney. But at this point, when she was representing Adnan, she just lacked the ability to make points. And I think that's the part that came from her illness and not her unethical behaviors.
So combined with the two elements of this, that the potential DNA and what I've read anyway and what I know of is that it's good to have another potential perpetrator instead of just trying to exonerate yourself. It is ideally good to have someone else. But combined with the two things, again, it's hard to predict, and appeals rarely are successful.
It's a long
shot.
Do you think
there's some ground for appeal here?
It's always a long shot. And Adnan's better off than most. He has a better chance than most. But it's always going to be a long shot, which is why I said his best hope is for the Innocence Project to come through, find the DNA, and test it. There is potential that if the evidence still exists and hasn't been discarded, it could be rewarding, especially given Jay's statements about the killer being concerned about DNA under the fingernails. and the fact it was never tested before. So there is reason to hope there, but it's far from guaranteed, and his other appeal options are slow and not necessarily going to be helpful in the end. If he goes that route and ultimately got free, it'd still be years, because there's appeals from the appeals. I think his current appeal likely will not succeed, which means he'll either have to start a new one or go through a federal appeal. And all that takes time.
Sure. Did the huge success of Serial, the podcast, 12 episodes, the investigation, and then, of course, what led up to the Innocence Project becoming involved, maybe it's a rhetorical question, was this Serial good for Adnan?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know that that on the one hand, it's going to be difficult for Adnan and anyone involved with him, because Sarah Koenig was putting on a story. It was an investigation. It wasn't entertainment, but it wasn't a PR piece either. It wasn't all favorable to Adnan, and it shouldn't have been. And she gave a thoughtful and thorough, well, as much as she could have been thorough, investigation of the evidence. So there was some stuff looks damaging to Adnan that came out. But none of that is outweighed by the fact that it's now gotten massive attention and popularity. And as much as the appellate system is designed to be more insulated and not swayed by popular opinion, there's no way it doesn't affect the judges. The judges and their clerks, they're listening to this. They know about it. They're paying attention. And even though they would never acknowledge that it affected their decision in any way, it absolutely is going to.
You know, I've done this program for about 5 years, and we do cases of wrongful conviction, and then, of course, there's authors that have come on. Michael Griesbach, The Innocent Killer, really profound case where a prosecutor had to go back and get a person out of prison that was wrongfully convicted, and in the end, they went back as a really gruesome killer. But anyway, what my point is that there are so many profound and blatant wrongful convictions that I have just, you know, touched on in the last 5 years. What does it hold for the future of wrongful convictions that something like this has caught the attention of the public in such a big way?
That would be the greatest thing Shirley could do, if it could, not just for Adnan's case,
right,
start some kind of reform in general, or just attention to the fact. Because so often people assume someone's convicted, they're guilty. And usually they are. But I think for the first time through Serial, it's entered the public consciousness that people are convicted, they aren't there for the great reasons, and they're actually innocent. And having that sort of public awareness will be reflected in the polls. And I think that there's definitely room for political campaigns now to try and focus on this issue. Whereas before, you're not going to have wrongful convictions be any kind of winning cause in politics.
What I found interesting, too, is that Sarah Koenig and the Serial podcast brought in, which is rare, I mean, you do get interviews with jurors, but these were profound interviews with a couple jurors that, man, one juror in particular, I thought, geez, they missed the whole trial. They were there the first day, but it seemed that they missed the whole thing. They summarized the first day and the theory, but I think they slept through the rest of it. But what I think is the service that Sarah and Serial podcast has brought is a big audience that weren't necessarily, they didn't think they were true crime fans, and now I guess they think that they are true crime fans by virtue of this Serial. But maybe people will be a little more open-minded to the idea of this trusted and judicial system is maybe not as, shouldn't be as entrusted as you might have thought all those years. And it brings up the problem, too, is that you listen to Jay, you listen to some of his friends, you listen to Adnan, and you're going, I don't know, because there's so much subjective evidence as well that can really confuse you, that I think people are realizing the complexity of a true crime book that even after an hour of discussing it, you just barely scratch the surface mm-hmm. of the story itself, never mind the issues and never mind the possibilities, especially when it's not clear-cut, which is many, many times who the killer really is.
I agree entirely. I think one of the best parts for me about Serial has been being able to discuss the case with my non-lawyer friends, because usually discussions of cases I have are with other attorneys, sure. with people with similar mindset. So Serial was the first time where my friends without a legal background, like, we've had long discussions about a legal case. And for me, it was fascinating to realize, just as an attorney, how insulated my mindset is, or just how things I know about the legal system and failings I fully expect to see didn't faze me at all. And my friends are just asking, wait, they can do that? That's allowed? This is what happened yeah. in real life? And I'm like, yes, this is actually how the system works. And for me, it was eye-opening to realize I'd forgotten that it's, for most people who are not involved in it every day, they have a more idealistic view of what's going on. And Serial is a really good exposure to the sausage-making process, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, the imprecise system that it really is, because we love Law and Order. I love Law and Order. I mean, I've got cable just so I can watch that every day. I love Law and Order, but that gives you a false impression of the precision that every trial has, and the conclusions, and the ethical morality behind all of this, and these people taking these cases home. Like you say, sometimes it's just a sausage factory, and there's conclusions leapt to, and people just sort of know, they believe they know who did it. And because it isn't very precise, and because not all the protocol is tended to 100%, it's kind of rough. It's certainly not as slick and precise and nice as we see on television. So I think that's what people are realizing, too, that you can be an amateur sleuth for these 12 episodes. You can read your blog and still not have any more of an answer than you or I has, as
yeah.
to Adnan's guilt or Jay's guilt, or really, really what happened in the story.
I think what Law and Order and shows like that fail to convey is the way the system is just, like any other, a bureaucracy with people trying to serve their own interests. And that's not to insult it, that's how everything works. But
sure.
Law and Order does not convey that you've got police with pressures against them to try and solve crimes. You've got prosecutors with heavy caseloads who have, to be honest, mostly, vast majority of the time, guilty defendants. And they're trying to make sure that some slick defense attorney doesn't try and get their client acquitted wrongfully. And then you've got judges who have heavy caseloads too, and they're busy, and they're sometimes going to take the prosecutor's word for it just because they assume the prosecutor's not going to state the case wrongly to them. So at every level, there's no need for wrongdoing. It's just people trying to do their jobs, but the way everything's set up and the way the system is set up, these results do happen because people are trying to get their job done. And sometimes that involves cutting corners when they think someone's guilty and should be in jail.
Well, it certainly is a fantastic illustration of true crime at its finest, in terms of there are so many people that roll up their sleeves in the investigation, and yet still. And you talked about all the people that weren't lawyers that were engaged because of this. And what I found, and this is what I found in the last 5 years, that there's so many people out there that aren't attorneys necessarily, that really have a grasp of law. And it must come from reading some of these books itself and watching these programs, and just who knows exactly how they got to that point. There are some people that are certainly naive, but there's certainly a certain camp that understand, I think, the principles of law, that yet are still enraged, outraged, disappointed, or are asking for, you know, the prosecution and the entire judicial system to conduct itself according to the principles that it says that it does, because otherwise we can have problems like this. I'm sure that the Serial program has not been good for the prosecution in Baltimore.
No.
When You know, so I mean, it's all a, I think it's a good thing for fans, and I think it's just a good thing for justice in general by doing the more in-depth analysis into some of these cases.
There's a disillusionment going on, which is valuable and needed. At the same time, most prosecutors do great jobs every single day. This is not, it's not as simple as prosecutors are corrupt, because they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Some are,
no.
Like in any area. But for the most part, prosecutors have a very hard job, and they're understaffed, under budget, and they do a hard job every day, and they do the right thing most of the time. The problem comes from a system that assumes that they will always do that, or assuming they have some sort of immunity from doing a less than thorough job. So there's a balance to be had there for sure. But at the same time, I think right now, more exposure to the problems in the system is needed.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you and commend you for your analysis of it as well, because it's a very complicated case. And I think having listened to the 12 episodes, I could listen to them again a few times. And I think that's what other people have done too. And so many amateur sleuths have, again, rolled up their sleeves and said, I'm going to weigh in here and try to find out. And the incredible amount of posts and commentary on this has been incredible. I wanted to ask you about LL2 and a little bit more about the blog itself and your commentary and how much attention you've had from you engaging and speaking and discussing about the Serial podcast itself.
It's definitely been interesting to have. I mean, usually I write about really obscure topics, which I enjoy. I've written many, many pages about very tiny details in international procedural law, which I enjoy, but I'm not going to get many readers for, which I'm fine with. But it's fun to have readers too. And it's interesting to have. It's a weird tension, because I feel like in some places I've gotten undue weight, and well, I'll put out a theory, and I think it'll probably get, I don't want to say uncritically accepted, because I think I'm right. I believe I'm right. But there's less pushback than I think there should be, because I work hard at developing my theories and my analysis of the law. But I think what Serial's been so great about is getting so many amateur sleuths, like you said, and they have some really great, like, everyone has really great ideas. Like, there's bits and pieces coming from everywhere. And I definitely don't want to do anything to stifle that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a great addition to the Serial podcast, because as much as they can cover in that great amount of time, and I know I cover quite a bit with an author in an hour or an hour and a half, as opposed to typically some of the interviews that they might do on other, you know, terrestrial radio or television, which is just maybe 10-minute interviews or less.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the more discussion, absolutely, the
absolutely
better.
And I think it all comes back. I was going to say, the fact that the jury convicted Adnan in 2 hours always blows me away. Thinking of all the really good discussion of the 12 episodes of the podcast, for all of that to exist and for a jury to come back with a verdict in 2 hours blows me away.
Yeah, and it seemed incredible. But that's, again, what I found was when they interviewed the two, she had the brief interviews with the two jurors, I really did shake my head in terms of, it was such a complex case. Again, it wasn't a case where, I mean, really, it was a technical case, so that there was these main issues that they had to deal with. And when you just had a very, very brief interview, it was very telling that these people were not the best jurors. And, you know, at least for the defense, especially, they weren't good choices for the defense. That's certain.
They didn't get it.
Yeah, and 2 hours is a very, very rushed judgment, I would think, regardless of, you know, especially for a case like this, it seems a lot more complex.
Certainly.
I wanted to thank you for coming on and talking about the view from LL2. If people are interested about this, your blog and some of your work, tell us how they might contact you. And are you interested in Facebook friends?
Sure. My blog is at viewfromll2.com. Right now, it's mostly Serial, but if you try and follow me. I promise there will be much more boring stuff eventually. And you can friend me on Facebook at, I think, facebook.com/SueSim, but I don't remember that. But yes, thanks for having me on. It's been great fun.
Thank you very much, and I hope to hear from you again soon. I'm sure you'll be tackling something again quite big. You might say boring, but I think might be very big, and then we might hear from you again. So I want to thank you very much. You have a great night. Thank you.
You too. Thank you.
Okay. Good night.